Welcome to It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copeland. Featuring stimulating in-depth interviews with special guests from all areas of the arts. And now, here's your host for It's a Question of Balance, Ruth Copeland.
Welcome to the show where we balance the intellectual with the creative, exploring whether we have more in common than divides us through thought-provoking conversations. For the topic hour, I go out and about and talk to people on the street about a wide variety of different subjects that affect all of us, both locally and globally. And for this, the Arts Hour, I interview local, national and international guests from all areas of the arts. And I combine a debate topic with an arts interview because I feel discussion and creativity are two of the most vital ways we engage with the world. If you'd like to find out more information about the show, you can go to the website. It's aquestionofbalance.com. You can hear podcasts of all my past shows there, and you can connect with me on social media, should you wish. And if you enjoy this interview today, be sure to tell your friends about it. Send them to itsaquestionofbalance.com, and they can click on the guest tab, and then they will see a picture of all the guests, and you can choose to listen to the audio whenever you want to at your convenience. So again, that's itsaquestionofbalance.com. Well, this week, as my special guest from the arts, I'm pleased to be interviewing Maria Semple, screenwriter, producer, and best-selling author. As a screenwriter, Maria's work includes Beverly Hills 90210, Mad About You, Ellen, and Suddenly Susan. Her production credits include Mad About You, Suddenly Susan, Three Sisters, and Arrested Development. Maria left TV to write fiction and has published three novels. This One Is Mine, Where Do You Go, Bernadette, and Today Will Be Different. Maria's first novel, This One Is Mine, is about Violet, who is living in Hollywood and appears to have the perfect life, except she is deeply unhappy. She finds herself risking everything to find herself again. Described as a compassionate and wickedly funny satire about our need for more, the novel explores the often disastrous choices we make in the name of happiness. Maria's second novel, Where Do You Go, Bernadette, is a runaway international bestseller. Spent a year on the New York Times bestseller list, has been translated into 18 languages, and is to be made into a feature film. The New York Times states, the tightly constructed Where Do You Go, Bernadette is written in many formats, emails, letters, FBI documents, correspondence with a psychiatrist, and even an emergency room bill. Yet these pieces are strung together so wittily that Miss Semple's storytelling is always front and center in sharp focus. The novel tells the story of an agoraphobic revolutionary architect, wife, and mother, who, struggling to adapt to a life in Seattle, disappears. The novel, told from the perspective of Bernadette's 15-year-old daughter, is a touching look at misplaced genius and a mother and daughter's role in an absurd world. Maria's latest, much-anticipated novel is Today Will Be Different, described as a hilarious, heart-filled story about reinvention, sisterhood, and how sometimes it takes facing up to our former selves to truly begin living. Born in California, Maria spent her childhood traveling around Europe with her bohemian parents until returning to LA for her father, Lorenzo Semple Jr., to work on the Batman TV series. Once Lorenzo was established as a writer, the family moved to Aspen. Maria attended boarding school at Coate Rosemary and college at Barnard, where she majored in English. She currently lives in Seattle, where she moved in 2008 with her partner George Mayer and their daughter. Welcome to the show, Maria.
Thank you, Ruth.
So I always like to ask people, I'm wondering, can you remember the first time that art of any kind had a deep effect on you, whether it was a book or a picture or music, when you first realized that art has a power just beyond entertainment?
It might have been when I was about 10 years old. I remember being very affected by the book Harriet the Spy. I felt like that really spoke to me because it's about a girl who's I don't know, maybe she's 10, 12, 13, and she's a loner, and she doesn't really understand the adult world, but so she kind of goes around as a spy, taking notes and observing the adults around her. And I think that it was really powerful for me to read about someone who was a loner and curious at the same time. And I think that it's not a coincidence that a lot of writers really were very impacted by that book as children, because I think that it kind of captures to me what a writer's personality is, which is that they're very interested in people, yet they like to be alone and kind of observe at a distance. You know, they're not true loners. They're interested in social entanglements and the behavior of people. They might not necessarily want to be involved. They'd rather write about it.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, that's interesting. I mentioned some information about your early life in the introduction. Would you say you grew up in a creative environment, or did you find art for yourself?
I very much grew up in a creative environment. My father was a screenwriter, and his uncle was the playwright Philip Barry, who wrote the Philadelphia Story, and my father is very literate and kind of grew up around the arts himself, and then became a writer and traveled a lot and was a theater critic and a playwright, and then wrote Batman, and which kind of determined his career. And then he went on to write a bunch of movies and became a very kind of influential screenwriter. And what I learned from that, really, and it's interesting because I bring up Philip Barry, it's because it's what he said he learned from Philip Barry, which is that the writing life is a good life. You know, as a kid, you look around and you think, oh, everyone's sitting around and drinking and laughing and having a good time and kind of trying to seduce each other with ideas and humor. And it just seemed like a very elegant, intellectually kind of rigorous and an enjoyable way of life, kind of for the social aspect as much as anything else. And I think that one of the really important things that my father gave me is he and my mother were really, really big readers. That was number one. So there were always books, and they were friends with a lot of writers. And so we had writers coming over to the house. And I also saw that writing was a job. And as I grew up, and as I'm an adult and I meet other writers, I see how even the concept of becoming a writer or thinking you're going to support yourself as a writer is something that doesn't even occur to people, you know, often. And it takes them a long time of kind of finding themselves and having the courage to even kind of announce to themselves or publicly, this is how I want to make a living. And to me, it just seemed like a very natural way to make a living. So I think that in a way, that really helped me.
Yes, yeah, that's true. Do you remember the first thing you wrote yourself that impressed you as a piece of writing that you thought, oh, I might actually have some talent in this area?
Oh, no, I can tell you about a lot of things that did not impress me that I wrote. I think those really are the ones that have stayed with me, the things that that impress me. I think I kind of slough off. But
yeah, I guess maybe with having a father who's such a good writer, that maybe that's a sort of pressure in a way. You probably judged yourself and your own writing perhaps quite strictly.
Yes, I did. And I feel like it took me a really long time to find my voice. I was an English major, and obviously I wrote a lot of papers, and I wrote good papers, but I didn't feel like that was my voice or that was a calling. And then I went into screenwriting and TV writing, and I did well in my career, certainly, you know, and I was very employable, and I did a lot of work that people like. But, you know, the whole time I really... It was hard for me, and not in a good way. It felt like this kind of frantic struggle that I wasn't hitting the mark, and it was not a happy feeling for me. And it was I only in retrospect, looking back, kind of can identify it as such. I think I just thought that's what it was like to be a writer. It wasn't until I started writing novels that I really felt like, oh, this is what I was born to do. And it was wasn't until I was, I think, 40 years old that I even started, or it wasn't until I was 40 that I wrote fiction for the first time. And as soon as I did, I just knew this is my form. And that to me is what I'm really proud of.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, you studied English and then you started out writing scripts. What attracted you to that form of writing initially?
I really think it was just to try to impress my father. I mean, I think that's
right.
Probably fundamentally flawed, you know, which is why, and, you know, I can't sit here and say it wasn't a good career and I didn't do good work and make people happy with the stuff I wrote. So it's not like it was a failure or anything, but that I think that I, in a way, fundamentally went about it just because, not to overshare, but my father was, you know, emotionally unavailable, and he really did enjoy the presence of writers. And I think very early on, it was just a message to myself that if I wanted his attention, and who doesn't want your own father's attention, you know, that I would become a writer, and that would be the way that I would relate to him, is by being a writer, you know, and have that connection.
And also maybe write in the form that he wrote in too.
Exactly. And so, and that's the thing. And so that's why it seemed like the thing to do, you know? And so I did. And that's, I'd like to tell you I was a cinephile and, you know, and spent my youth in art houses, you know, watching Orson Welles movies. But I didn't, you know. It really was around me. It seemed like something to do. And I think that the thing that I was good at, that I now, perspective has given me, is the one thing I do think I had a really natural talent for at the time and still do is storytelling and just plot, you know. And I really love plot and I love storytelling. And I think that's innate in me. And I think that's bigger than any, psychological need, you know, to become a writer and impress my father or any of that stuff. I think that really was my talent. And it worked well with movies and TV because you're just largely, particularly in the rewrite room, if you're on a TV show, you're working on story. You know, it's just story, 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 story. It's called breaking story. You're up there at the whiteboard trying to figure out how to tell the story. And so I was good at that, and I feel like that's the thing that really I'm still doing right now, and I think that probably is my innate talent.
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah. I would think that was a great start for novel writing. Just briefly, you also have a lot of credits as a producer. Did that just come out of the writing because you're in TV, or did you have a particular interest in that?
Well, in TV, what's interesting is that the producers are writers. You know, I heard you say that on the introduction, and I think that probably it's divided. What happens in TV, I think on my credits online or whatever, probably say that I'm a writer and a producer. But what happens is when you're a writer on the show, they give you the title of producer. It's not like you're what's called a line producer. You're not there with a walkie-talkie doing the casting or doing the kind of nuts and bolts producing. So every writer is a producer, you know. So on every single episode of every single show I worked on, my credit is producer. And then the episodes I wrote, it would say written by. I would only have a couple written by credits on the shows. But because I was on staff and breaking stories and doing all this stuff that writers do on TV shows, and TV is very much writer driven. So when you're a writer on a TV show, you're not only writing the scripts and breaking the stories for the other writers and rewriting all the other writers' scripts, you're also doing the casting, you're going down to the set and working out the scenes with the actors, and you're, you know, dealing with the production heads. And so you are kind of doing producing, but it's always as in service of being the writer.
I see. Oh, that's really interesting because, of course, you know, outside of TV, what one has no idea how it works. So that's very interesting.
No, I know exactly.
Yeah.
And it's funny because I do see that it says that I'm a producer on those shows. And yes, technically I am, but that's just really I'm a writer on those shows is what it means.
Yeah, I see. Oh, well, thanks for explaining that.
And sure.
If you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter, producer, and best-selling author, Maria Semple. We're going to go to a break now, but we'll be back with more conversation after these messages.
Ciao, I'm Luca from Tramonti at 528 Seabright Avenue, steps from the ocean. We are the authentic Italian pizza and pasta restaurant, serving also organic salad and house-made desserts in a friendly family-style atmosphere, indoor or on our lovely patio.
Tramonti is open every day from noon to 9 and later on Fridays and Saturdays. Come enjoy our specials every Tuesday neighborhood night and the best deal for a healthy bite at lunch every day.
We bake our bread and prep our fresh pasta and pizza daily. Beppe, Daniel, and I want to say grazie to the Santa Cruz community for supporting us in the past 2 years. Allora, buon appetito!
Visit Luca and Beppe at Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue. That's Tremonti, 528 Seabright Avenue.
Hi, I'm Casey, and I'm the second generation owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz. We pride ourselves on being Santa Cruz's community bookstore. We feature an extensive selection of new and used books, children's books and toys, gifts, cards, magazines, and games. Our knowledgeable booksellers can help you find just the right book or gift. We hope you can join us for our author events each week, featuring best-selling authors and books of local interest. And if you can't get downtown, our website has over 3.2 million titles, which ship directly to your home. We even have experts on site to help you publish your own book or family history. Come visit us downtown or at our website, bookshopsantacruz.com.
Bookshop Santa Cruz is celebrating 50 years of independent bookselling in the community that we love. Visit Bookshop Santa Cruz downtown and join in the festivities as we celebrate our customers and the books that make it all possible. Bookshop Santa Cruz, celebrating an amazing 50 years in downtown Santa Cruz.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter and best-selling author, Maria Semple. And we heard from Bookshop Santa Cruz there in the break. And I wanted to let you know, if you are local, that Maria will be in Santa Cruz on the 28th of October at 7 p.m. Talking about her new book, which we will be also today. The book is called Today Will Be Different. And this is a ticketed Bookshop Santa Cruz event at Peace United Church. So you do need to get tickets, preferably in advance, because it'll probably sell out at Bookshop Santa Cruz or online at bookshopsantacruz.com. So again, that's 28th of October, 7 p.m. Maria will be here in Santa Cruz. And if you're not local, if you go to Maria's website, Maria Semple, that's S-E-M-P-L-E, Semple.com, then there is some information there, I'm sure, about her worldwide book tour. So you may be able to catch her somewhere else. So, Maria, before the break, we were talking about you working in TV, and you left TV to write fiction. What inspired the change of format for you?
I was always a big reader. I was an English major in college, and my love was always books. That's how I always wanted to spend time, is alone with the book. And I felt like being a novelist was just something that was completely out of reach for me. It felt like novelists belonged on this higher plane, you know, and that I felt like there was nothing about me that could possibly translate into being a novelist. You know, I felt like I'd have to almost transform my personality or something to become something as serious as a novelist. And it wasn't until I met a novelist, a guy named Bruce Wagner, who I loved his books, and I would always talk to him about his books and about books in general, and we became friends. And one day he said, why don't you just write a novel? And I thought, oh, I can't write a novel. There's no way I can do it. And he said, oh, come on, novels are just your personality, you know, and it's just your interests and your voice, and you have a terrific voice and a lot of interests, and you should just write a novel. And so he gave me, in a weird way, permission to write a novel, which I think is a very important thing for artists, you know, he did nothing but just allowed me to make this shift, which was, oh, I can be a novelist. And so I just gave it a try, you know, and I really had never taken any classes. I didn't know anything about it particularly. And I just tried to write the book that I would want to read and not make it bad. You know, my main thing is don't write like a bad book, you know. And so I really just tried to do it. And as soon as I began, I realized this was my form. I just loved it. I loved being alone. I loved having my time to myself, you know, and not being in a writing staff and trying to write with the 9 people around the table kind of shouting ideas at you. And I liked just the solitude of it and the complete freedom. And so to me, I've never looked back.
Yeah. Obviously, you're a hugely successful novelist now. However, you sort of faced what every writer dreads with your first novel, is that it didn't sell hugely. And I'm wondering what stopped you from giving up, you know, and perhaps moving back to TV where you'd had a lot of success and that would have been more perhaps comfortable, you know, to feel successful.
Yes. The main thing was geography, was that we had moved to Seattle from L.A., and then my book came out, and my book failed, and I was now stuck here, and I pretty much left the TV business, because the TV business really is in Los Angeles, so I couldn't go crawling back with my tail between my legs.
Bunt your bridges.
I know I couldn't, and I couldn't go begging for a job and say, oh, it didn't work out, you know, so I was really kind of cornered, you know, and so it was bad. And yeah, it was very painful for me, because I think it was a lot of the disappointment was really based in naivete. I didn't realize that novels don't sell, most of them, you know.
Yes,
I thought that, oh, you write a novel and then you become Ann Patchett or something.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't quite understand that the books that I was reading about were written by people who were overwhelmingly the exception to the rule, you know, which is that, you know, a bunch of novels come out, and even from big publishers, and they just don't break through all the noise, you know. And so I was very disappointed. I felt very ashamed of myself personally, because the thing about writing novels that I didn't really understand was that even though, you know, the last show that I'd worked on was Arrested Development, and obviously I don't think there's any novel that's ever been written that reaches as many people as one episode of Arrested Development, just the numbers aren't there for fiction.
Yeah.
And so I felt like, oh, I'm writing for this medium that's kind of goes out all over the world and everyone's heard of it and I'm associated with it and that's who I am. Mm. But what I didn't realize was that you're not really personally putting yourself out there when you write for TV. You know, it's collaborative. There's directors, studios, actors, networks involved in changing your original idea, you know, and then plus it's, if you're one tenth of, if you're successful, you know, every show belongs one tenth to you, even on the writing level, because you're, it's a writing staff. And so when my novel came out, I wasn't really prepared for how different it was in terms of really personally putting myself out there and saying to the world, this is the best I can do. I have nobody to hide behind. And it was that I think was made it feel particularly painful, you know, the fact that it didn't sell. And so I had no choice, but I couldn't really go back to TV, let's say, you know, I kind of left and I just had too much pride, or what was I going to do? Go move back to another city? And it just that wasn't going to happen. And I really did feel kind of burned out, and I was kind of naturally done with my course of doing TV in that form, you know, being like on a sitcom staff. And so I really loved writing novels so much. And the happiest I was in my life up until that point was writing my first novel, you know, and I thought, I'm a novelist. And if no one believes I'm a novelist, it doesn't even matter because I know I'm a novelist. And so I started Where'd You Go, Bernadette, really with this defiance, you know, like it was really kind of a tantruming child, you know, as I thought, I'm just going to write a novel. I don't care if nobody wants to read it and no one's going to like it. I'm going to do it, you know? And so it was really this kind of animal self-will and kind of pride, you know, that made me write that novel. And again, as soon as I was writing the novel, it was the happiest I've ever been in my life. You know, it just made everything else fell away.
Yeah.
Because I love sitting there and writing novels, and I was so happy writing it, and that one connected with people, you know. So I got really lucky, and I'm incredibly grateful that happened, because I think that it is rare, you know, to have a second novel do so well, you know. And so I'm just incredibly grateful that it all worked out the way it did.
I mean, I think the process you've described is what a lot of artists, if you're making art as your life, have to face, you know. And it is this sort of place where you just have to find your own motivation within, no matter what happens externally.
And I never understand it when people say they hate writing, because I think, then how can you write? You know,
yeah.
How do you do it? I don't. I mean, if in that scenario, then on top of it, I hated writing. Like I mean, I wouldn't have written a book. I honestly don't understand that. And I say to people, I still, between us, think that they're just saying that. I don't know how you can. What would possibly motivate you to write if you hate it so much?
Because
There's almost the guarantee is that it's not going to be rewarding when you're done with it. You know, there's going to be, it's going to bomb, or you're going to get bad reviews, or it's not going to solve all your problems magically the way you think it's going to, you know? So there's got to be the love of doing it that's keeping you going.
Yes. Yeah, that's very true. You moved to Seattle in 2008, and I understand you found it quite difficult to adjust, and you've commented that you couldn't have written your internationally best-selling novel, Where Do You Go, Bernadette, today, because you now like Seattle. I'm just wondering how it feels to sort of encapsulate parts of yourself and your life forever in a piece of art.
It's very strange, because I realize that I'm the kind of writer who I think I take great risks in that whatever I'm going through in the moment, I'll just throw into my book and think that's valid.
Uh-huh.
That's what my art's going to be. And I don't, I'm very, I'm so specific about it that I don't even ask if it would resonate or if there's anything about it that people might relate to. I think it's almost this defiant part in me that just thinks, oh, I saw that today, I'm going to throw that in my book, you know? And so I kind of go through my draft process doing that, and I write my first drafts very quickly.
Mm.
So my books do become real snapshots of kind of 3 months in my life. And I'm very grateful for it, because I think it gives it a lot of emotional rawness. But then I can go back in and do drafts and drafts and kind of make the whole thing work. But I never touch that kind of strange emotional specificity, you know, because I think that is what kind of contains the spooky power, you know. And so I like it. I look back on it, and it really feels like a different person wrote it, you know. And even now, I think maybe a month ago, I was somewhere where they asked me to read a passage of Bernadette, and I hadn't read from the book in maybe 2 years, and I just had my old copy, and I brought with me, and I just opened to the page that I normally read from, and even in that 2 years' time, about halfway through, I just thought, God, I can't read this. This is so, like, nasty and mean. I just couldn't believe that, A, I had written it, and B, I'd gone around on tour for 2 years reading this passage. You know, I was like, my God, what part of me did I think that this was entertaining? You know, it was so strange. So I like it. It's just kind of a strange out-of-body experience to look at this stuff that doesn't particularly represent who I am at the time, even when the book comes out.
Yeah, absolutely. You've got a very funny video trailer for Where Do You Go, Bernadette, that in part makes fun of it being an epistolary novel with people warning you not to mention that. And
yes,
one of my favorite novels of all time is Smollett's Humphrey Clinker. I don't know if you've read that. It's an epistolary.
I know that.
Oh, you'd really like it. It's an 18th century novel, and it's an epistolary novel. It's really funny. So I actually like that format. But how did you come to write the novel in that structure?
It took me a while to kind of figure out. See, one of my favorite books is Les Liaisons Dangereuses, right, which is a French epistolary novel. And I love the form of it. And the Wilkie Collins, The Woman in White, is also kind of an epistolary novel. I mean, it's not... It's maybe written in, I don't know, 4 or 5 letters. You know, it doesn't use the form really to its full extent. Les Liaisons Dangereuses does, but I love that form. Just, it was always been one of my favorite forms. And so when I started writing the novel, Where'd You Go, Bernadette, I started writing in a first person, and then I... realized it just didn't work story-wise. You know, there were things that I needed to withhold for storytelling purposes, and I couldn't make sense of why, if it really is a first-person narrator, why they aren't just giving you this information. You know, it didn't... it was really a formal issue that I had with the form of first-person. And so then I thought that... I think I first came up with the idea of her having a virtual assistant, of Bernadette having a virtual assistant. So I thought I would just write an email to the virtual assistant, just almost as a writing exercise. And as soon as I did that, it seemed so funny to me of this woman kind of oversharing very inappropriately to someone in India, you know?
Yeah.
And it seemed really just awful and funny. And so I then thought, oh, maybe I'll write another letter. And then it just kind of all came together very quickly. And again, it was really a solution to a problem is what it was, you know? And I loved it because I felt like I really pushed the form as far as I possibly could, you know, by really, really working the story possibilities of the form of the epistolary novel.
Yeah. Your latest novel is Today Will Be Different. For listeners who haven't read it yet, could you give them a brief synopsis without giving too much away?
Yes, well, it's the day in the life of a woman named Eleanor Flood, who's from Seattle, and she wakes up in the morning with an incantation, which is today will be different. Today I will be present. Today I will play a board game with my child. I will initiate sex with my husband. I won't swear. I will look people in the eye and listen deeply to what they're saying. You know, today I will be my best self, the person I know I'm capable of being. Today will be different. And it's just, I think, how all of us, in a way, wake up and just think like, okay, let's try to just have it together today. Like I failed yesterday, but today let's just try to keep it together on just a very basic level. You know, she's not trying to change the world or do any great heroic act. She just, as she says early on, just doesn't want to make the world a worse place. You know, at the end of the day, she doesn't even mean to make the world a better place. She just wants to kind of go through without doing harm. And so it's, she starts out that way and then life happens and things go awry and it follows her through the day. And she makes discoveries, kind of self-discoveries, and then discoveries about other people. And there's a portion of it that takes her back to another chapter in her life that takes place in New Orleans. It's kind of interesting. And there's a graphic novel in it. There's an illustrated section.
Yeah, it's beautiful. So, yeah.
Yeah, and so it really is just about someone trying to, someone realizing they have all the tools to be a happy person and to be a loving person, and yet they always just get in their own way.
Yeah. And also perhaps about perspective, because we all tend to be very hard on ourselves, don't we, I think, in how we view what we're achieving in life.
Yes, very much so. And that's, I think, one of the themes of the book is just is the struggle, you know, is trying to exert a lot of self-will onto your daily existence, you know, and whether that's the right approach to just muscle through, or if there's another alternative to muscling it through. And that's really kind of what I'm writing about.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Interesting. It's a very fascinating thing that for all of us, I think, if we are really being present in our lives, is something you have to confront. Yeah. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts this week, screenwriter and best-selling author, Maria Semple. We're going to a break now, but we'll be back after these messages.
Do you like the music from It's a Question of Balance with Ruth Copland? Have you ever wondered what the full songs sound like? Now you can find out by listening to the new EP, It's a Question of Balance Music, available from iTunes, Amazon, and itsaquestionofbalance.com.
No white horses to play the game, and I wish I knew. Something about you in the rain. Did I or didn't I say it's forever? Well, I know I said it, baby, it just goes nowhere. Well, we can do the things we want. We can do the things we like. But if we're taking all the time, well, I just don't think that it's right. Just that. I think that there's more to us than just that.
It's a Question of Balance Music. Download individual tracks or the whole EP from iTunes, Amazon, or itsaquestionofbalance.com.
Can you imagine living without stress, anxiety, or fear? And can you imagine a life filled with harmony and inner peace? Is that even possible? The Ananda Yoga and Meditation Center in Scotts Valley offers simple tools to help you become more effective at work and more centered in the face of life's challenges. At Ananda, we offer yoga classes for everybody, inspiring workshops, devotional chanting, and Sunday services based on the teachings of Paramahansa Yogananda. Our teachers and therapists are highly trained professionals who work together to inspire a healthier you. And your first Ananda yoga class is always free. Visit us at anandascottsvalley.org or call 338-YOGA. That's anandascottsvalley.org or 338-YOGA.
Welcome back. You're listening to It's a Question of Balance with me, Ruth Copland, and my special guest from the arts, best-selling novelist Maria Semple. And if you're local, I just wanted to remind you again that Maria will be in Santa Cruz on the 28th of October at 7 p.m. talking about her new book, Today Will Be Different. This is a ticketed Bookshop Santa Cruz event at Peace United Church, and you can get tickets in the bookshop or online at bookshopsantacruz.com. And if you're not local, then if you visit mariasemple.com, you could get information about the rest of Maria's international tour. So before the break, we were talking about Maria's new book, Today Will Be Different. And you've set this again in Seattle, Maria, like where do you go, Bernadette? And in a way, Seattle is almost a character as well as a setting. What is the significance of the backdrop of Seattle in this novel compared with Where Do You Go, Bernadette?
Well, again, because I write my books in such a rush and I really draw on just things that happen to be at hand, It works out that I write a lot of specifics about what I see in the moment. And at first, when I was working on Today Will Be Different, I thought, oh, maybe I need to change the setting and maybe I should just write about what's around me. And then when I'm done with it, do a search and replace and make it Chicago or do something. I don't know why I even thought that, but I was slightly hung up thinking like, oh, do I want to write about Seattle? And then I just really couldn't come up with a compelling reason why I shouldn't write about Seattle.
Yeah.
And so, I love writing just the specifics of what I see around me, and I think it's important to write with authority, you know, and to really be able to nail the details. And so it just makes sense to me that if I can observe it and I experience it, just if I can put my singular experience across, then that is what art should be, and I might as well just go for it.
Yeah. You worked writing comic TV scripts, and all your novels have comedic or satirical elements. I'm wondering what advantages you feel comedy has for delivering meaning, which perhaps straight drama does not.
I think that you can be... I think that comedy is disruptive, you know, in a way that drama isn't. I think that the instinct of comedy is really to expose and to cause trouble and to kind of slash at something. And I think that maybe that impulse is more entertaining.
Yeah.
And I think that you can probably kind of make more points doing it that way than being more direct.
Yeah.
You know, I think that there's something that's indirect about comedy that counterintuitively makes it land harder than kind of straight up drama.
I always think maybe it kind of gets in the back door. It enables us to sort of tolerate absorbing challenging ideas about the world or ourselves that perhaps otherwise, if they were just presented as drama, we would reject them.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's just about the way you look at the world. You know, when I was a comedy writer working on TV, I would watch dramas and I would think like, wow, that must be nice just being able to like have an idea and then write your idea. You know,
yes.
With comedy, you have an idea and then you have to think about how to make it funny and how to be sly about it. And, you know, there's and this is not to... I don't know that I could write drama, and there's fabulous drama that is not just like an outline, you know, that's just put on screen. And so I would actually like to talk to a drama writer about that, about what the, I'm sure that they would come back at me and say I'm wrong about it, but that's my experience of it, you know, is that comedy's harder, you know, there's a movie, My Favorite Year, and Peter O'Toole has a line in there that says, dying, he plays an actor, and he says, dying is easy, comedy is hard, you know? And that's a big quote for comedy writers, you know, dying is easy, comedy is hard. So that's one of our mantras.
Yes, yeah. I mean, I don't want to be knocking dramas or drama writers. Obviously, there's some fabulous examples in those genres, but I do think that the best comedy is also drama, and therefore you've almost got two things you're having to do at the same time. So I'm always very impressed by people who write comedy.
Yes, I think it's harder, you know, myself.
Yep.
But there's fabulous drama that I could never come close to. pulling off, you know, that I'm in complete awe of. That
yes, yeah.
I enjoy and I'm just completely transported by it and amazed by it. You know, I don't begin to understand how they do it.
Yes, yeah. I have a master's degree in counseling, specializing in arts therapies, and so I'm really interested in how art affects us. And my favorite psychologist is Alice Miller, who's written a lot about how people process difficult events through art, whether these are events they've experienced themselves or events they've witnessed. So I'm wondering if you feel art can have a healing effect on both those making it and those experiencing it.
Gosh, I'd have to say yes. And I don't think I know enough about it to make generalizations about it. But I do think that in terms, you know, something that occurs to me as you say that is that I was once on this Buddhist retreat with a Tibetan Buddhist teacher named Robert Thurman. And Buddhism talks about non-attachment a lot, you know, and you're just kind of let it be. And it goes back to what we were saying earlier in the program about self-will and about just struggling and trying to impose your will on things. And you wake up every day and today will be different. Today I'm going to do this, you know, and that's really what my book is about.
Yeah.
And so I kind of understand that that's flawed in some way, you know, in the AA or Al-Anon programs, you know, that's self-will is bad, you know. In Buddhism, it's called attachment, you know, that it's bad, you know, it's like to be attached to an outcome, you know.
And
you're taught in all these different ways that that type of thing is bad, you know. In Christianity, it's like God's way, you know, they talk about, you know, and to not be following God's way is arrogant, right? So I remember saying to Robert Thurman, who's a, you know, brilliant scholar, saying to him, okay, I can't resolve this because I'm an artist and art is not just going to happen on its own. You know, you're not just going to chill out and let go and then art will be created. Like, so I don't understand. Is there no place for art in Buddhism?
Yes.
You know, and what he said was that at least in Tibetan Buddhism, like there's the bodhisattvas who take vows that they will not reach, that they will hold off their own enlightenment until everyone else is enlightened, and then they will attain enlightenment. And he is saying that being an artist is that's the role of a bodhisattva, that what you're doing is you're basically putting across other experience so that people will have empathy and therefore will be closer to enlightenment. You know, that in order to have enlightenment, you have to be empathetic to every single experience in existence. You know, you have to be at one with every experience in existence. It's a very like cosmic crazy concept, you know, in the way the Tibetans think about it. But it did make me think that, oh, so an artist really is, if all I'm doing is putting one very specific point of view out there that people might not think about, have thought about before I wrote it.
Yeah.
And if they can therefore open their hearts up to this other human experience, then I think in a cosmic level, the artist is doing something for the greater good, you know, because you're opening people up to other people's experiences. And if that's done 100 times, 1,000 times in Tibetan Buddhism, 1,000,000,000,000 times, then we will all reach nirvana, you know? And so it's a very small step, but that's kind of how I've been able to resolve it myself. You know,
is just
think, okay, I'm going to be very specific about what I'm writing here and these people, and hopefully other people can empathize. And then in terms of, it's got to help the artist. I mean, I would just say there's probably a personality type that needs to do what it's doing, you know, which is make art, and it might be unhealthy. You know, I often think that being the what's making me write novels, and again, with my self-will that wants to really impose my will on the world, I've got to believe it's not that healthy of an impulse, but it's what I have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it's kind of working for me. So it's like the way that I'm sick, you know, and it, and it, I guess, is somehow not doing that much harm. So I should probably keep doing it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, from my perspective and sort of understanding also of like Vedic philosophy, I think there's a differentiation between the kind of negative will, if you like, of the sort of selfish ego, and then the will that it takes to actually do anything in the world, which I think is the kind of will you're talking about. And in sort of Vedic philosophy, they actually talk about cultivating that, you know, but it's sort of differentiated from just sort of pursuing your own interests at any cost.
But you know how it's always hard to figure out what is the good kind of energy? It's like, you know, because if you really read deeply about it, it seems like they think you should just be sitting there blissing out, and anything other than that is an illusion. You know what I mean? And so you think, oh, God, how do I make sense of all this?
Yes, yeah. Well, it is true. It takes some deep thinking, and that's also what comes through art, isn't it? It's a way of processing. All these huge questions that we all have about our own lives in the world. And well, we just have a couple of minutes left, so I don't know if you can answer this briefly. Your three novels are each a sort of a woman who's in a place of sort of cognitive dissonance, if you will, where they're exploring that. Is there an overarching message you're trying to convey through all three novels, or do you feel they're all different?
They're different, and I never try to write a message, and I feel like once you even think in terms of having a message as an artist, I think you're toast.
You know?
I just think it's over for you. I think then you're just preaching, you know, and then you're just making people take their medicine, you know, which is not what art should be. And I think you should want it to be more enjoyable than that for people, you know, than just to kind of bully them with your point of view. You know, I think there should be more entertainment involved. So I think that I'm always going to be in a way writing the same novel, you know, and I think that all novelists in a way are writing the same novel. And so I feel like I'll always be kind of writing what I'm going through. And I've really given myself permission to do that. You know, I see a lot of people trying to really write a completely different novel than they did the last time. And a lot of times I think that that's maybe for the wrong reasons.
You know?
I think my novels are all very different. But to me, I see that I'm kind of writing them from the same place. But it doesn't mean that they have to appear on the outside as the same novel. I think the reading experience of all my novels is strikingly different.
Right, yes, yeah.
But it can come from kind of the same core.
Yes, yeah. Well, we've come to the end of the show, sadly, but thank you so much for talking to me, and we're looking forward to seeing you in Santa Cruz on the 28th of October, and I'm sure everyone else on, I know you're on a world tour, or at least, you know, outside America, so we wish you all the best with that.
Oh, well, thank you, Ruth. It's been a pleasure. I can't wait to go up to Bookshop Santa Cruz.
Great. Well, we look forward to that. And just to remind listeners again that you can go to Maria's website, mariasemple.com, to find out more information about her tour, her other books. And again, she will be here talking about her new book, Today Will Be Different, on the 28th of October, 7 p.m. at Bookshop Santa Cruz. I hope to see you there. Thanks for joining me, and I will see you next time.